You know, if it's not about sports, I find it very hard to concentrate.
Greetings, fellow sports likers. Welcome back to season two of my podcast, In This Corner with JD, Sports Writers Talk Sports Writing. I am JD, John Doyle, and in this corner this week is Luke Eplin. And he's written a great book titled Our Team, The Epic Story of Four Men and the World Series That Changed Baseball. More on Luke in a minute. As I've mentioned in the past, I have a Substack newsletter, and it's a website that you can go to. It serves as a companion to this podcast, and you can find it on the web at johndoyle603.substack.com. Its number one purpose is to direct you, the listener, to a number of different things. Most importantly, links to the things my guests have written and where you can buy their books. And you can find links to other episodes there, not just the most recent one, because you can scroll down to previous posts. Here's the cool thing. At Substack, you can subscribe, and whenever there's a new episode, it goes right to your email inbox. You can click on the podcast link right in the email, and it will start to play. That's how you like to listen. I'm not going to stop you from doing that. We're also on Twitter at ITC with JD and at John Doyle 603. And I post links to the podcast and other things as well on those Twitter feeds. It's Memorial Day weekend. Happy Memorial Day to those who celebrate. And I'm recording this on Friday. If you were paying attention to social media on Thursday night, you may have heard or seen that the New York Yankees and the Tampa Bay Rays changed up their Twitter feeds. Instead of corny jokes and game highlights, they posted nothing but facts about gun violence in the wake of the most recent mass shootings. And to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure how I felt about it. On the one hand, the Twitter feeds posted facts. They're not something to agree or disagree with. They're facts. Both accounts posted the exact same tweets on both feeds, and here are two examples of posts they shared. Here's one. Every day, more than 110 Americans are killed with guns, and more than 200 are shot and injured. And another one went, access to a gun triples the risk of death by suicide. Again, these are facts. You can't agree or disagree with facts because they're facts, not opinions. But I do agree with the sentiment that people need to be exposed to facts. I know it's a strange idea for some people. And the fact is, this country has a serious problem when it comes to easy access to firearms. On the other hand, it's a complex problem, one without an easy answer, considering the United States has the Second Amendment and there is an entrenched culture of gun fanatics in this country, which elects politicians who maintain the status quo. So whatever the answer is, it's not going to be found on Twitter, no matter who posts facts and opinions, whether it be politicians or private citizens or professional sports teams. And to be honest with you, I'm not crazy about team Twitter sports feeds. Now, as you know, I'm an avid user of Twitter, but I rarely go to official team social media feeds and websites because that's basically like getting information from state-run media. I prefer all my news, let alone sports news, to come from independent sources. Plus, official team feeds tend to be overly sarcastic and corny, and it's like they're all trying to one-up each other with the corniness and the jokes, and I don't know. They're just really obnoxious for the most part. So when they all of a sudden try to take a moral stance, even if I agree with it, it's hard to take them seriously. Now, when it comes to politics and sports, a lot of people's knee-jerk reaction is to say, hey, stick to sports. But it seems to me that people only say that when the athlete or the organization says things that they disagree with. Hey, stick to sports, they say. Shut up and dribble. You've heard this all the time. And for me, I just think it's human nature. I'm a liberal. I've espoused liberal views on this podcast and social media. And when I hear an athlete say something political and I agree with it, I applaud it. I might retweet it or something like that, but there are a lot of conservative characters in the sports world as well, and if they say something shitty, my instinct is to say, hey, we don't pay you to run your mouth, we pay you to pitch with a bloody sock, you know? Yet I tend to be on the stick-to-sports side even when I agree with whatever political view the athlete or team expresses. There is something to be said for sports being an escape from the grimness of the world, and I don't think the average sports fan, myself included, should feel all that guilty for turning on a sporting event and just expecting to see a sporting event. And there's a lot you can add to the stick to sports sentiment. Attending a sporting event or tune into one on TV, and it's just an onslaught of schlock. You got the pregame show, the endless commercials and promotional product placements, and the musical acts and the jingoism and the over-the-top player introductions. Sometimes, actually all the time, I just want the damn game to start. So while I obviously applaud the Yankees and the Rays for using their Twitter feeds to shed some light on a serious problem, I personally would not have been outraged if they hadn't done it either. Okay, it's spring, and with the warm weather comes the distasteful practice by some to stick their feet out the window of the passenger side of the car. If you do that or are thinking about doing that, here's a public service announcement just for you. Number one, no one wants to see your feet. Number two, it's dangerous. If you get in an accident with your car, you could really get injured if your bare feet are sticking out the window. And finally, what is so bad about sitting up straight? Try it sometimes. It's not that bad. Anyway, Luke Eplin is our guest. His book, it's been out for about a year, and I do believe it's out in paperback or is coming out in paperback very soon. It's called Our Team, the epic story of four men in the World Series that changed baseball. And that World Series is the 1948 World Series, and the team is the Cleveland Indians. They won, they beat the Boston Braves to become the first integrated team to win the World Series. Now, this year, of course, marks the 75th anniversary of Jackie Robinson breaking baseball's color barrier, but it's also been 75 years since the second black player in the major leagues, and that, of course, is Larry Doby, who was also the first black player in the American League. He was signed by Bill Veeck, and Eplin makes the case that neither Doby nor Veeck have gotten their due as key figures in the history of baseball and of the nation, and Eplin does a great job of telling their story. And of course, there's a lot more to this book as well, so here's me and Luke Eplin.
So the 1948 World Series, every time I think about it, I think, okay, so Cleveland beat Boston in a one-game playoff. Had that not happened, I live up here in New Hampshire, I'm a Red Sox fan. Mm-hmm. Had the Red Sox won that, that would have been the only, I guess they would have called it the trolley car series. It would be the only time the Red Sox and the Braves would have had all Boston World Series. So I guess I'm a little... when I think about that, obviously I wasn't alive, but you get a little bitter about that because that would have been great for history, but wouldn't have been the same for your book. So that actually worked out pretty well for you. What made you think that this was a great idea for this book?
Well, it's the first integrated team to win the World Series. And so I think it's often overlooked in terms of the integration story. The integration story is now almost synonymous with Jackie Robinson and Brooklyn Dodgers. And so someone like me who grew up a big baseball fan who loves to read about baseball history knew nothing about the 1948 Cleveland Indians, very little about the participants in it, very little about someone like Larry Doby, who I think is just as pioneering as Jackie Robinson. But I knew him only as basically a trivia question, that he was the second African-American player in Major League Baseball. But here you have the first integrated team to win the World Series and a team that is, I think, as meaningful and as significant in terms of advancing civil rights and integration and things like that in Major League Baseball history. And so if someone like me who purports to know a lot about baseball doesn't know the story about this, I imagined that a lot of other people didn't as well. And so that's a great basis for a book.
And I'm glad you wrote it, because Doby to me has always been a very mystical character. Again, like you said, there's not much that we know about him. And of course, this year we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of Jackie Robinson integrating the major leagues in April of 1947. And rightfully so, we should be celebrating that. But I think Doby kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And you definitely talk about this in the book. We forget that he played his first game only 3 months after, what was it, like 11 weeks or something like that. Yeah. And he played in the American League. So it's kind of interesting, because I think we live in an era now where obviously we have interleague play, and a lot of people don't realize that the American League and the National League were two distinct leagues, you know, different league offices, different baseballs. Now with the Universal DH, there's basically no distinction between the two leagues. But also, I feel like Larry Doby, we know that the horrible racism that Jackie Robinson faced in that first year that he played and throughout his career, really. But Doby sort of had to bear that brunt of the racism on his own as well, just in different cities. And, you know, if there had been interleague play, they had both played in the same league, maybe they could have shared that a little bit and taken the burden off of each other. But in a way, they were both two men on their own.
Yeah, they're two different men with two vastly different experiences. Jackie Robinson, when he comes into Major League Baseball, is 28 years old. He's already been through a year and a half of minor league and spring training experiences. Branch Rickey, who was the president of the Dodgers at the time, did not believe that it would be a good idea to sort of bring a Negro League player directly into Major League Baseball, or put him down into the minors in Montreal to not only sort of see his skill set, but also to acclimate him to all white clubhouses and to allow his white teammates to sort of acclimate themselves to the idea of integration. And so Robinson not only has that sort of transitional period, he's also a figure who's pretty well known to white America. He was a big star on the UCLA football team. His feats were sort of broadcast across the nation. He is a name that is widely recognized. And so people know who he is. They know of him. He's a mature individual. He's gone through sort of a transitional period. Larry Doby is the opposite in all of those respects. He is 5 years younger than Jackie Robinson. He is not well known to anybody outside of Negro League Baseball, basically. White people have basically never heard of this individual. Don't know anything about him. And Bill Veeck, who was the owner of the Cleveland Indians, had a very different philosophy than Branch Rickey. He thinks that Negro League players are ready right away to make it to Major League Baseball. He has a very high opinion of their talents. And so he believes that rather than putting a transitional period that would put a lot of pressure on Doby to perform in the minor leagues, just throw him into the major league fire and see how he adapts to it. So Doby literally goes from playing a game in the Negro Leagues to a game in Major League Baseball overnight. It's just completely different experience that he goes through than Jackie Robinson. And as you said, it's not that far apart. They're only sort of 3 months separated from each other. And so basically you're seeing two different ways of integrating Major League Baseball, and it leads to two different results, basically.
And when you say overnight, you're talking literally overnight, because he was playing for Newark, I believe, in the Negro Leagues, got on a train. I don't know. I can't remember what you read. Was it Chicago or Detroit, where the Indians were playing? And within 48 hours was on a Major League Baseball field.
Not even 48 hours. He gets signed. He doesn't find out he is signed by the Cleveland Indians until around July 1st or July 2nd of 1947. They decide that he's going to play another game for the Newark Eagles. He plays for the Newark Eagles in the Negro National League on July 4th, which is a big sort of, you know, date for Negro baseball. He plays that game, quickly dresses, goes to a train station in Newark, takes an overnight train to Chicago, where the Indians are playing the White Sox. And that very next afternoon, he is dressed up and coming to the plate as a member of the Cleveland Indians. So literally he goes about maybe, 24 hours from one to another. And the shock is so great to his system, because he himself has not had time to process what is going on, that Larry Doby would later say that in his first, say, 10 at-bats in Major League Baseball, he cannot stop his teeth from chattering. It's just such a tremendously monumental thing that has happened to him. When he's in the train station in Newark about to board an overnight train, he is not sort of feeling triumphant or expectant or hopeful or anything like that. His head is in his hand and he's kind of shaking and barely speaking. It's just such a monumental life change that is happening to him, and he can't quite wrap his mind around it. And Doby himself is a very shy and introspective person, regardless. He is not somebody who feels necessarily comfortable sort of touting himself or in crowds or things like this. He's just kind of an introvert. And so this whole thing was just a difficult sort of shock to his system that it basically takes an entire year for him to get over.
Yeah, because he struggled a lot in that first year, and then really had quite a turnaround in 48 when the Cleveland won the pennant and subsequently the World Series. Now, your book revolves around four main characters. We talked about Bill Veeck, who we'll jump around. We'll talk about each of these, who was, you know, the very famous owner of several ball clubs and known for his, you know, really bringing baseball into the modern age, as we know, with giveaways and promotions, stuff that's, you know, de rigueur now in Major League Baseball. Bob Feller, who by 1948 was a veteran pitcher. He had fought in the war and had made his Major League debut with not 12 or 13 years earlier. Doby, of course, and Satchel Paige, a legendary barnstorming Negro League baseball player who eventually makes his Major League debut in 1948. So jumping around a little bit, if you don't mind, talking about Bill Vacca, you make the claim that he was as big a force in civil rights in baseball as Branch Rickey was. Again, we're talking about Jackie Robinson overshadowing Larry Doby. In a way, sort of Branch Rickey overshadows Bill Vacca when you make the case that you know, Vacca was just as instrumental in integration.
Yeah, if Branch Rickey hadn't integrated Major League Baseball, Bill Vacca was going to do He had his sights set on doing that as early back as the early 1940s. He grew up in Chicago. His father was the president of the Chicago Cubs. And Chicago at that time, and basically through the existence of the Negro Leagues, was kind of known as the nerve center of the Negro Leagues. It's where the annual East-West All-Star Game happened. And it really was kind of the center of the action. And so Vec grows up going to not only that All-Star game, but a lot of sort of Chicago American Giants game, which was a Negro League team there. And he sort of sees and understands the power of Negro League players, in particular Satchel Paige. He's really taken by Paige, the sort of showmanship and just skill set that Paige has. Vec really wants to sign Paige as kind of a lifelong goal of his. And so he doesn't subscribe to this sort of theory that a lot of white executives and players did, that these Negro League players were more sort of performers than athletes. He sort of recognized that these people would be just as good in the major leagues as they were in the Negro Leagues. And it's only the color line that is keeping them from doing so. And so he knows that if he buys a team like the Cleveland Indians, which is a smaller market, sort of out of the way team from like the Bostons and the New Yorks and things like that, a great way to get the roster up to snuff and in competition to those larger teams is by integration. And so he's doing it both for the sort of practical means. He's doing it because he has been a sort of studying the Negro League since he was a kid. And he really firmly believes in civil rights. He's somebody who joins the NAACP. He's somebody who kind of cuts advertisements for getting rid of segregation policies. He's a real sort of progressive individual. And so he kind of makes Cleveland at that time, during his very short tenure as owner of the club, the most integrated team in Major League Baseball. He really stocks his minor league system with Black players. And so it's not just something that he's doing competitively. It's something that he really believes in, not only on the field, but he also hires ushers and he hires the first Black executive in Major League Baseball. He really kind of takes an organization-wide approach to integration, which I think shows how deeply he believed in it.
He owned the St. Louis Browns. And he bought Cleveland as kind of a reclamation project, really. You know, he sort of, like you said, you know, it was away from the, you know, big baseball cities like Boston and New York, but also because they were so terrible and he thought he could make them into a winner. That's what he sort of liked to do.
Yeah, Cleveland, they weren't necessarily terrible. They were more like just kind of middle of the road, did not ever get over sort of the hump of making it to the World Series against sort of powerhouse teams like the Red Sox, Yankees, or Tigers. And the leadership, the ownership group that owned the Indians before Vec bought it was very sort of traditional, old-fashioned in their approach. They believed that promotions sort of denigrated the quality of the game. They believed that things like fireworks or promotional giveaways or things like this sort of made baseball into a spectacle and things like that. And so they were very badly undersold, and which led to sort of low attendance marks. And Bill Vec just threw that all out the window. He really wanted fans to come to the games and he wanted them to be entertained while they were there. And so he starts just doing things like hiring coaches that are clowns, shooting off fireworks, doing all of these sorts of things. He's essentially inventing the modern stadium experience Cleveland. I think that anytime you go to a game now, and it doesn't matter what, it could be hockey, baseball, basketball, whatever, you're going to see sort of t-shirt cannons and like all of these giveaways and things like that. That's all basically from the mind of Bill Beck. Like, yeah. We might not recognize the name Vex so much anymore, but if you go to a game, you're going to see his fingerprints all over the place. Like, he is so consequential in just what it feels like to go to a major league game of any sport. Everybody has adopted what he was essentially inventing right there in Cleveland.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, to say the least. Those of us, a little of that goes a long way. I love going to professional sporting events, but some people take it a little too far, in my opinion. But that's another topic for another podcast. Talk about one of the more mystical characters in all of baseball history, Satchel Paige. You know, how you talk about how he grew up in the deep South. In a way, the impression that I get is that he was more of a, not, I don't want to say more of a businessman than a ball player, because he was definitely a ball player, but the guy knew how to sell himself, you know, and talk, you know, pioneering. I mean, that's all, you read about that all the time, you know, athletes and their personal brands. And one of the reasons that he didn't go to the major leagues was because he didn't think the major leagues would be as profitable, literally, you know, but, you know, Beck gets him on that 1948 team.
I think that Satchel Paige is the most entrepreneurial athlete this country has ever produced. I think that if you look at the what he did under the circumstances that he did, I don't think it could be replicated. He is from, as you said, the Deep South, and it was during a time of just extreme segregation, Jim Crow laws, lynchings, threats of violence all over the place. And he not only makes himself into a superstar at a very early age, he turns himself into basically a one-man franchise. He adopts a persona, which is kind of like a slow walking deadpan sort of individual that then throws the fastest pitch that you could ever see, that just excited crowds all over the place. People would cheer Paige not only when he was pitching, but whenever he just walked onto the field, people just could not get enough of him. And so really he kind of pitches for various Negro League clubs and then sort of leases himself to whatever clubs would pay him to pitch one or two games for those teams. And so he's just pitching constantly, all the time, every day. He's on the move, he's on the run, and he's making more money in the 1930s during a time when the Negro Leagues are in the collapse because of the Great Depression than major league superstars are at the time. He really becomes the model of the athlete as businessman. And I think that you can look at sort of, you know, other examples over the past few decades. I think Michael Jordan would be the foremost example with the sneaker brand. And that is really impressive, but it's not as impressive of what Satchel Paige did during a time of Jim Crow to kind of build himself up into probably the most sort of legendary and talked about baseball player of his time. What you had said was Paige saying that he didn't want to go to the majors because he couldn't make enough money. He would often say that when people would interview him, because the white press really latched on to Paige. I mean, at a time when the mainstream white press did not pay attention at all to Negro League baseball, Satchel Paige penetrated those pages. And they would ask him, well, if you're so good, why aren't you pitching in Major League Baseball? And Paige would always say, because they can't pay me enough. And I mean, it was obviously, you know, not exactly the most truthful answer, but on some level it is, because he probably was making more just on his own than he could have been in Major League Baseball. And one of the things whenever Bill Beck signs him is that Paige says to Beck, I do not want a pay cut. And so Beck has to give him $25,000, which is, to get put it in perspective, there were three other black players in the major leagues at that time. That is about the combined salaries of those three other players. And that includes Jackie Robinson. So Satchel Paige was a tremendous businessman. And I think that that gets lost in the sort of, you know, way that we think about him as this sort of, you know, showboating sort of, you know, colorful individual. But he was penetrating and intelligent and incredible.
Barnstorming to me is one of the most fascinating aspects of, you know, early 20th century baseball. When you consider that these teams, obviously they didn't fly by jet, they had traveled by train. And it was a lot of times, okay, well, you know, St. Louis to Boston is a 3-day trip. We're going to stop and play the textile. Well, like, for instance, the, you know, growing up in Manchester, New Hampshire, we had the textile workers, you know, the Boston Red Sox would come up to play them. And this was in like, you know, 1916, completely unheard of now for that to happen. And that was Satchel Paige was very comfortable with that lifestyle, you know, doing that. It wasn't like, you know, he, and you wrote that he would like sort of be paid to make it. He was lent out from Negro League teams, you know, just to make an appearance for one team on one day to play in a barnstorming game.
Yeah, well, barnstorming for Negro League players was kind of a way of life. Like these Negro League clubs, because they did not own their own stadiums and because they had to play under suboptimal conditions, would play sort of league games against each other. So that would be like if two main teams like the Kansas City Monarchs and the Pittsburgh Crawfords played each other.
Yeah.
But then while they were traveling to wherever they needed to go, they would just stop off in various towns or other places and play sort of factory teams, local clubs, you know, college teams, something like that. And so they were just sort of constantly playing all of the time to keep themselves solvent. Satchel Paige would, you know, pitch a game for the Kansas City Monarchs and then sort of make it be known that for the next 3 days he was available. And people would just sort of buy for his services, which he would give for a certain fee and a cut of the game. And then in the off season, whenever Major League Baseball ended in like October or something like that, there would be sort of a period of time where the weather was warm enough where baseball could still be played. And Major League Baseball players would have a couple of weeks there where they would just sort of form ragtag clubs among themselves and some other amateur players and sort of go to places that didn't get to see Major League players, you know, because there was only all the teams at that time were east of the Mississippi, except for St. Louis. And so they would kind of go to the west or they would go to the south or they'd go wherever and just play against other clubs. And so it allowed these fans to see them and they could do things that they couldn't normally do in a major league game. Most notably, they could play against all black players. And so that's where you got sort of major league players such as Joe DiMaggio, Bob Feller and whatever playing against Satchel Paige and all that. Those were in barnstorming games at the end of the season. And Satchel Paige was just kind of recognized as being the one that the major leaguers wanted to face. Because they, you know, they heard about him and they wanted to see what the hype is about. And games where Paige pitched against major league players were just, I mean, they were sensations. Mm-hmm. People would just, you know, pour out of the cities to see them.
That gives us a good chance to segue to Bob Feller. Now, Feller played in a lot of these, like you just said, a lot of these barnstorming games. So he was familiar with the black athlete, for lack of a better term, but wasn't necessarily convinced that black players would fit into the major leagues. And then 1948 comes along and he's really struggling. He is not having a very good season. And then Satchel Paige comes. What was that relationship like between Feller and Paige?
It was more of a sort of business relationship than a friendship relationship. Mm-hmm. They sort of recognized each other as the best white and black pitchers of the time. And so they knew that if they squared off against each other with the headline saying Feller versus Paige, that would bring out more fans, which would then sort of give them more money. And so they knew that was a way to sort of boost their own bottom lines. And so they were just kind of, they were fire and water. Like Paige was so sort of colorful and interesting. Mm-hmm. Feller was a little bit stubborn, a little bit, his views on race were interesting. And I think that you have to go back to the beginning. He was somebody whose origin story, I think, is completely unmatched. He was a kid sensation, grew up on a farm in small town Iowa. His dad sensed this tremendous ability in him from an early age. So he cleared out a portion of their pasture, built him a baseball field right there, essentially the field of dreams. He grew up on this baseball field playing against men many years older. By the time he's 17, he kind of by happenstance makes it onto the Cleveland Indians roster. And in his very first start, he ties the American League record for strikeouts. Four starts later, he ties the major league record for strikeouts. He is so popular that at age 18, he is on the cover of Time magazine, and his high school graduation is broadcast live on NBC radio from coast to coast. And so Feller sort of has this sort of Americana feel to him, this sort of boy that sort of pulled himself up by his bootstraps, made it through hard work and dedication to the majors, and then just kind of like set all the batters on their ear. And Feller not only sort of uses that narrative to his own economic advantage, he really starts to sort of like believe in the sort of American dreamness of that narrative, where like you can take somebody who is in this very out of the way place, who has no sort of connection, but if you, you know, give them, if you just sort of work and work and work and work and work and sort of put in the effort, you can become something in this country. And I think that he views sort of race through that prism. The way that he talks about Black athletes is not like, I don't want to be on the same field with them. He, you know, certainly competed against them all the time on the Barstool Trail. It's more that he says like, well, some of them are pretty fast, but they don't have all the qualities to become a major leaguer. It's, you know, even Paige, he'll be like, well, he doesn't really have much of a curveball. He doesn't seem to have worked on his arsenal of pitches. And so it's this sort of idea that if they had put in all the effort like I did, then they would have broken through and made it in. It's this sort of, you know, his own narrative in some ways blinds him to the barriers that he didn't have to face. And so, yeah, he has a sort of blinkered white view of why Major League Baseball is segregated.
And of course, the baseball world sees how well Cleveland did with players of color, wins the World Series. And that sort of sped up full integration in Major League Baseball. It took a while to come to Boston, but for the most part, you know, people were on board at that point.
Well, Larry Doby comes into Major League Baseball. Unlike Jackie Robinson, Robinson had sort of a rough first month or so, and then he really kicks it in 1947 and has a tremendous year, really leads the Dodgers to the World Series. And everybody knew that Robinson was this amazing athlete. As I said, everybody knew who he was. Nobody knows who Larry Doby is. He looks terrible in 1947. He doesn't look like an athlete at all. And I think if any other owner had owned the Indians, they probably would have cut him. But Vec not only keeps him, he gives him a shot in 1948. And Doby has this miraculous turnaround from somebody who doesn't look like he's ready to somebody who really leads the Indians into the World Series. Without Doby, they do not make it. And everybody sort of knows that. And so the idea is not that sort of Jackie Robinson is exceptional. The idea is then becomes, if you sign a Black player, really sort of have patience with them and develop them, they can make the difference between whether you, you know, or stay in the middle of the pack or sort of break through to the promised land in a way that you haven't been able to do before. And so then you get this sort of very different idea of integration. And you see clubs in 1949 really start to follow the Indians' lead.
So you grew up in St. Louis. And in my opinion, there are three great baseball cities in America, New York, where you live now, St. Louis, of course, and Boston. So I'm assuming you grew up a baseball fan. You know, probably obviously you weren't there when the Browns were there, but growing up in St. Louis, did that give you more of an appreciation for baseball than, say, if you had grown up in, an NFL city like Cleveland or something like that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the St. Louis Cardinals in St. Louis are still front page news of St. Louis newspapers, even in the off season. Whatever they do is gospel. My father had season tickets before I was born, and so I grew up going to a lot of games. And he listened to every single game on the radio. And at that time, Jack Buck was the announcer for the Cardinals. And so Jack Buck was really the voice of my childhood. I had Cardinals games on in the background constantly. And just like, it's in a tremendous history of that franchise and the way that the city treats them. We are really spoiled in St. Louis. The Cardinals are kind of a magical franchise. They're winning games they shouldn't win. They're winning World Series they shouldn't win. Mm-hmm. They're sneaking into the postseason, you know, on last days of the year. And I think one of the challenges for me writing a book about the Indians is that that was the opposite in Cleveland. The Indians are constantly blowing things. They're constantly being beat whenever they should be winning. That happens in 97. It happens in 2016. It happens all the time. The Indians are a cursed hard luck franchise, and fans are sort of expecting them to fold, to, you know, not win the big thing. Whereas Cardinal fans are expecting things to go our way all the time. It's a very different mindset of a fan base.
It really is amazing. And one thing that I've always found fascinating about the Cardinals is, and I think this is part of the reason why they became such an iconic franchise, is because you mentioned Jack Buck, is because of that radio station, KMOX, for many years was just blasted across the entire Western United States at night. And that's why, you know, when St. Louis was the westernmost team, people in places like Arkansas, Kansas, Nebraska, they were all Cardinals fans, really.
Yeah, all the way station. Over to all the way to Colorado. Like, I mean, I remember as a kid taking car trips from our home in St. Louis to the Rocky Mountains mm-hmm. and Canlex never faltered. You could just kind of hear the Cardinal games all the way out there. So when you go to a game at Busch Stadium, you will see people from Tennessee, from Arkansas, mm-hmm. from Mississippi and things like that. Cardinal country spread far and wide across that area. It got sort of, you know, chopped into when the Braves moved to Atlanta and when teams started to come into Texas. But yeah. like it still really penetrates in a way that, like, if you look at the sort of Kansas City Royals fan mm-hmm. base, it's kind of a small blue dot where it is, whereas the Cardinal yeah. fan base is this big red blob that spreads out across a large area of the United yeah. States.
Yeah, really. It's sort of like the Houston Texans and the Dallas Cowboys. If you look at the right. fandom of the state of Texas, it's one little dot where Houston totally. Is, even though Houston's a great, great football city. And also, if I'm not mistaken, this is just something anecdotal that I heard once, but it made a lot of sense. One of the reasons that the Royals and the Cardinals had AstroTurf on their stadiums, you know, throughout the 70s and 80s mm-hmm. was because people were coming from so far away. They wanted more of a guarantee that the game would be played. And now with, you know, AstroTurf dried a lot better than natural grass. Now with modern drainage systems, that's not as much of a big deal as it would be. Maybe that's right. Maybe that's wrong. I can't remember, you know.
That's fascinating. I didn't.
Yeah.
You know, it's yeah. it's interesting because it is so far ingrained. When Bob yeah. Feller was 15, the Cardinals were in the World Series in 1934, and yeah. he and his dad drove down from Iowa to mm-hmm. St. Louis. And so it was a sort of idea that if you live west in the Mississippi, the Cardinals were somehow yeah. your team. And now, I mean, that sort of largeness of the fan base and the way that the Cardinals still sort of have great teams is really the only thing that we can lord over Chicago. Chicago is kind of our mortal enemy. Yeah. And everything is better in Chicago than in St. Louis, yeah. except for the Cardinals. So that's why 2016, when the Cubs won, was so traumatic for St. Louis, because we kind of lost the one gloating thing that we had over yeah. Chicago was their ineptness in the postseason. So
Boston and New York, you know, same deal. I mean, you know, that's why this century has been a godsend, you know. I mean, it's like, yeah, the Yankees still have the 29 World Series or whatever it is. But for this century, I guess, can't, you know, 4-4, 4-1. And of course, the Patriots and all that good stuff. If you have a couple more minutes, I just wanted to ask you, you know, how'd yeah. you go about writing this book as far as the research? I mean, it must have just been tremendous amounts of time in libraries or online and in interviews and that sort of thing. And yeah, I mean, this book is so well researched. I was very impressed. And congratulations on that.
Thanks. I wish that I'd started 10 years earlier, because everybody in the book is dead. And so the only member of the Cleveland Indians who was alive from that team was Eddie Robinson. He was their first baseman. He lived to be 101. And I spent a weekend with him at his house in Fort Worth, Texas, when he was 98. And he still had tremendous memories of the whole thing. But I really did have to rely on archival research, on sort of newspaper things and all that. And what I realized was that I think one of the reasons why the Larry Doby story and the Cleveland Indians story doesn't resonate as much is because the narrative has been lost. Like, we can say the Indians are the first integrated team. We can say Larry Doby was the second major league player, Black African-American player in Major League Baseball. But that doesn't tell us, like, why that's interesting or why that's sort of meaningful. And so what I really wanted to do with this book was try to put you right in the middle of it, to sort of make you feel what the country felt at that time and why this team was so exciting, and that, like, the city just went so crazy over this Cleveland Indians team. Mm-hmm. And so I don't really have a lot of statistics in there. I don't have a lot of sort of historical analysis. It's really, I wanted to tell it almost like a novel, so that then you sort of get the sort of visceral reaction to why this is interesting. Because I think that the Jackie Robinson story, the reason why we it's so resonant is because we know so much about it still. We know that sort of talk that Branch Rickey had with Jackie Robinson, the sort of turn the other cheek. We know a lot of the sort of visceral things that Jackie Robinson went to in terms of the racism and all the sort of shunning and things like that that went on. Well, with Larry Doby, we don't have that sort of recall. We just have this sort of trivia questions, like who was the second? And so I really wanted to sort of revitalize that. And so that's how I chose to write the book that way.
Excellent. But just seems like a Larry Doby movie is due. Has anyone reached out to you about that, or?
We've sold the movie rights.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the movie rights have been sold. There is a script being written right now. Yeah. Had some interesting conversations. And yeah, I do think that it would be quite cinematic. We'll see. I mean, you know, the way that Hollywood works is that it's nothing is done until it's done. So so I hope something happens, but it's a tough sell. You know, Cleveland, it's an out of the way city. And but I do think it would be quite, I mean, Satchel Paige would be incredible to see on the screen. So
yeah, it's kind of amazing how there hasn't been a major biopic about him yet. But again, another podcast topic, and I wish you luck on that. And if that does, if we are fortunate enough to see that on the big screen, I'd love to have you back on to talk about that. Luke, it was great talking to you.
Awesome. You too.
Thanks to Luke Eplin. There's a link to where you can buy Our Team, the epic story of four men in the World Series that changed baseball on our Substack page at johndoyle603.substack.com. Hit subscribe. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at ITC with JD. You can follow me personally on Twitter at johndoyle603. Our cover art was designed by Michael Doyle. Find his artwork on Instagram. The link to his Instagram page is in our show notes. That's it. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to tell a friend, and we will talk to you next week.